Welcome to Meet the Writers. My guest today was born in the US and has spent much of her life in London. She's a former Europe editor and editor-at-large of Time magazine and the author of Amortality, The Pleasures and Perils of Living Agelessly, and the Sunday Times best-selling biography of Prince Charles, Charles, the Heart of a King. In 2015, she co-founded the Women's Equality Party with Sandy Toksvig, and she's just come out with a new book. It's called Attack of the 50-Foot Women, How Gender Equality Can Save the World. Catherine Mayer, welcome to Meet the Writers. Thanks so much for coming on. As listeners might have gathered by your CV, feminism is something that looms large in your life. And I wondered, because obviously it's a term we're going to use a lot in the next half an hour, if you could tell me what you understand by that term.
My view of feminism is something extremely inclusive, which is important to say because people assume that what you mean is putting women ahead of every other gender. Whereas, of course, what you're really talking about is about creating the possibility for equality in a very real way. And I have to say, one of the other reasons that I wrote the new book is because I couldn't find anywhere a book or a piece of writing that sufficiently explained to me the different waves of feminism, which, of course, we're used to talking about. So I was born and grew up during the second wave of feminism, which is the one that most people kind of associate with the media construct about bra burning and out on the streets demonstrating, but in fact is about a lot more than that. It was about looking around and seeing the extraordinary inequality that there was, the fact that women were shut out of not just high office, but all areas of life, all areas of economic activity, and had very little control over their bodies, over their reproductive functions, and fought for some very basic rights and achieved amazing things. And then you go into other waves of feminism that start to look at other aspects of what is holding women back. Because, of course, what we can see now in 2017 is that any number of laws for equality have not yet created equality. So just to give you the most obvious example, there is still a gender pay gap across the world, even in countries that have laws that say you must pay women the same for equal labour. So what you've had to do with feminism is to look, I mean, I'm what's called an intersectional feminist, so I look at the intersections between different kinds of disadvantage. So, for example, the ways in which a woman of colour will be even more disadvantaged potentially than a white woman, and try and find ways to move everybody forward. So the short answer I should have given you at the beginning is feminism is something that makes the world better for everyone.
How did you first become aware of it? Did you grow up in a feminist household?
I grew up in a household that was quite radicalised in many different ways. But the funny thing, looking back, which I have done for this book, but also since founding the party, is to realise how much we are products of our own time. And both of my parents were, in their different ways, feminists and are. They're both still very much alive. My mother, who I write about in the book, she went to university at a time where women went to university only in order to be educated to find a better class of husband. And she left early to marry my father, and neither of them thought anything about that decision. So although they were in many ways ahead of their time, they weren't that much ahead of their time, and they were very much pinioned by it. So their own development since then has been very interesting too.
You've always had this idea in your mind of a sort of country, a fictional country that exists in which everybody would be completely equal.
Yes, but I mean, the funny thing is I'm a science fiction fan, so I think I have spent a lot of my life imagining alternative universes, so it comes more naturally to me than other people. But it wasn't until I was actually actively canvassing, advocating for a party, advocating for gender equality, that I realised that most people don't have that idea in their mind. Most people sort of say, yes, gender equality would be good because we see this study that says it'll add trillions to GDP. But they don't actually think, well, what would that world look like? And so I guess I've just always had that shining image in my mind of what a great place it would be, and I want to live there. Mm. So I felt it important. Again, I was looking for reading material and I couldn't find anywhere that ever addressed the question, what would this future look like that we're working towards? I did find in Germaine Greer's Female Eunuch, which had been a text that I had read years previously and then enjoyed revisiting very much, a very dismissive phrase where she says that any kind of projection of the future is inevitably wrong and sterile. And my answer to her is that to fail to try to anticipate that future is in itself also very dangerous. We have to think about the things that are happening in today's world that could shape the future for good or for ill, and to try and work out what they are and move them.
Of course, your background is as a journalist. How did you start writing?
I had the weirdest route into journalism, accidental. Everything big that I've ever done in my life has been entirely unplanned. I was very poor, living in London, you know, poor in the way that nice middle-class students are poor, but I had no income. And somebody told me that there wasn't a cash-in-hand job at The Economist logging orders for their big red desk diaries. And so I went there to do that. And while I was doing that, I don't know how, but somebody in their marketing department noticed that I could write. And next thing I knew, I was employed as a marketing executive at The Economist, writing direct mail shots for the said big red desk diaries, telling people how much more wonderful they would appear to the rest of the world if they had one of these monsters on their desks. From that, I one day came back from lunch and found on my typewriter somebody had pulled out an advert from The Economist itself saying that there was a job going upstairs in editorial. And I was young and naive and had no idea that in journalism there is this sort of church-state divide between, or there was, it's eroding, but between advertisers and editorial, and particularly at The Economist, and that they would look down their noses at me. I also had no idea that as somebody who had not gone to, you know, the sort of usual combination of public schools and Oxbridge, and in those days was quite foreign as well, I was still pretty American, that I would be quite exotic to them. And I applied for the job, and I think I surprised them so much that they gave it to me, although with strong reservations. And I was also one of very few women on staff.
And then you went on to Time magazine, of course.
Yes, although I had an even stranger career path than that, because I went to Time, but via a couple of other magazines. I always ended up in magazine journalism, but for 11 years I wrote in German. I was the London correspondent of a German news weekly called Focus. So it's been a career path that I feel very confident in saying nobody else has followed or probably ever will follow.
And then books, of course. So your first book was all about living agelessly. I love the fact that not only are the pleasures, but the perils of living agelessly. What's the downside?
The downside is that a denial of mortality, which is what part of this is about, a denial of ageing and mortality, carries all sorts of benefits, including, interestingly, longer and better health often. But it can also lead people into forms of denial that either stunt them emotionally or make them very vulnerable to snake oil salesmen peddling various youth elixirs, which of course never work, and can make them very angry when they come up against the actual irredeemable fact of ageing. Mm. So it's a very interesting one, because you absolutely can think yourself old, and the sort of, you'll recognise a kind of strain in the media here that loves to purse its lips and tut over women in particular who dress inappropriately. Mm. We're very much told how we should be at certain ages, and that is unhealthy, and it's also reductive. It's very bad economically too. So interestingly, some of the thinking I was doing around amortality has been very helpful now, because I understood the ways in which older people are excluded from the workforce and to the detriment of their own health, which again then tends to load pressures onto the NHS and the taxpayer and everything else. Mm. And you start to understand a lot more about how diversity actually works. You know, people talk about diversity in this really tick box way. Oh, well, we need to have a diversity of people on our board because it looks better. Well, no, actually, it's better in so many other and much more profound ways.
Mm. And better for the economy, as you were saying.
Yes, better for socially, better for the economy, better because also you do get these different perspectives. You know, one of the research I remember looking at for amortality about how age-diverse workforces are actually much more effective than, you know, that there's an idea that younger people will be less prone to taking sick days. In fact, it's the other way round. But that age diversity also helps because you find that the intergenerational exchanges are really helpful, the perspectives that each generation can bring to another one. And diversity's like that in many more ways. Mm. You know, I mean, so there are so many different kinds of diversity. Diversity you can see and diversity you can't see. But diversity of thought is the thing that really matters.
You then went on to write about something completely different. I couldn't really get further away from the subject. And not a book that I would have, by looking at your history and anything about you, would have thought that would interest you. Why Prince Charles?
Well, it actually started when I was writing for the German magazine. The Germans love stories about the royals, but I was also doing it at a time when stories about the royals were huge news, because it was, you know, in the 90s with the breakup of the Charles and Diana marriage and everything else. And I started out being very resentful and thinking of these as soft news, and I was only interested in serious subjects. And then I realised by experience of trying to cover these stories how incredibly difficult they are to cover because of layers of official secrecy and lack of real source material. Actually much harder to cover than straight politics, but I also began to understand their political and cultural significance, and that part of the way in which the prohibitions on what materials and what sources you can get for royals works is that it really damages people's understanding of what that institution is and how absolutely central in many ways it is to the political system here. And so I then became more and more obsessed with actually beginning to uncover that. And so the biography of Prince Charles that I wrote is something that I don't think anybody's ever done and may never do again, which is a political biography of a royal figure. But it's also just fascinating. I mean, the other thing is I managed to get, over many years, and not just researching that book, I managed to get behind the scenes in all sorts of royal palaces and meet a lot of key people. And it's this strange, otherworldly place, which is why I coined the phrase Planet Windsor. Hmm. And there's an awful lot of humour in it, some of it, quite a lot of it, unintentional.
Charles himself, did you meet?
Yes. There was a lot of controversy when my book first came out, which was quite funny, where at one point somebody in Clarence House seemed to suggest that I'd only ever met him for 9 minutes or talked to him for 9 minutes, which they would, of course, now confirm is absolute nonsense. I spent about 2 years in total focusing on researching him, because I also did a Time magazine cover story, which Clarence House liked so much that they put in their annual review for that year, which is one of the reasons I laughed so much when they were briefing against me. The reason they did, I think, was that they were unnerved by some of the headlines that came out of the newspaper serialization of the book. And, you know, I mean, it was, as I had told them all along, it was not going to be a puff job. I'm not interested in that. I wanted to get to the truth of who he was and what he was doing, and that meant showing some things that he's doing that I think people now think possibly more highly of him because, but also things that they didn't want out there, and showing the real influence and the skein of influence, which I think is incredibly important to understand.
Do you think he's a feminist?
Camilla is. I think he likes women. He has female aides and women friends, and he had quite a cold and difficult childhood. And he also likes the sort of warm people who will cut through some of the formality that surrounds him. But he, I don't think he's an intentional feminist, but I will say that the success of that book actually helped the Women's Equality Party because it enabled me to spend basically a year setting up a party without an income of my own. So in that sense, I always say that Prince Charles is the biggest supporter of the Women's Equality Party.
Fantastic. Well, of course, setting up the Women's Equality Party happened, as you say, like everything else in your life, completely by accident.
Yes. It was a very busy period of time. Start of 2015, and I had just launched the Prince Charles book and just been through the firestorm of publicity around that. And I went to the Women of the World Festival at the South Bank Centre to an event about women in politics. And this was, of course, ahead of the May 2015 general election. And there were these very vibrant female politicians on stage from the main parties. I was just in the audience. And they were all talking about what their parties were going to do for women after the election. And it was really apparent, and I'd heard women talking about how they weren't going to vote at all as I'd been waiting to go in. And it was really apparent that instead of being excited by these women on stage, people were instead utterly depressed. And that vacuum was already being filled by populism in forms that I was worried by. And so I just stood up and said, during the question and answer session, and said, what about if I take a leaf out of UKIP's book? And we've already seen that UKIP, by winning votes, is encouraging the mainstream parties to make themselves more in UKIP's image. Perhaps if I can show that feminism is a vote winner, they'll do the same thing for feminism. And so I said, you know, what about a Women's Equality Party? If anybody wants to discuss it, I'll be in the bar. And people actually did come to discuss it in the bar and on social media. And pretty much by the time I got home, I discovered that people thought that I really meant I was going to start a Women's Equality Party. So it was a funny moment. And I rang Sandy.
This is Sandy Toksvig.
Sandy Toksvig. So Sandy and I are actually both involved in the founding committee of the Women of the World Festival, the WOW Festival. And so we had been talking about how disappointed we were to find ourselves at our age still having to even be involved in a festival like that, that is necessary to promote women and to show what women can do, and that we wondered what mechanisms there might be for speeding things. So I rang her to tell her, oh, look, I seem to have accidentally founded a party. And she said, but that's my idea, darling. And she was planning the finale for that year's WOW, which she always does at something called Mirth Control. And she was planning a fantasy women's party that was a sort of fantasy government. And she said, I was just about to ring you and offer you the post of foreign secretary. So we founded a party.
And, of course, it's gone from strength to strength.
Yeah.
Now, you don't lead the party, though, which is unusual for the founder. Why is that?
I didn't think that I was the right person to lead it. And Sandy agreed the same thing about her. We thought we were sort of too, in some ways, too metropolitan and too media for the kind of big mass movement inclusive party we wanted. But we also wanted to create a talent, a platform for other talent, to encourage other women. This wasn't about putting ourselves forward. This was about breaking open an existing club rather than forming a new one. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, one of the biggest things for this party has been to find ways of opening up and reaching into the kinds of communities that politics is bypassing altogether, and the women that politics is not addressing. And we were incredibly lucky because at the very first meeting I organised, a woman called Sophie Walker came along as one of the speakers, and I knew her. I knew her as an amazing campaigner on autism, and she held the room spellbound there. This sort of ad hoc steering committee emerged from that moment, and Sophie then emerged as the leader of the party. And she has developed, as we've watched her, from somebody who had a natural but very raw talent into this phenomenal public speaker and phenomenal leader. And so I don't know what the odds are on having, you know, at your very first meeting, somebody who turns out to be a really, really skilled natural politician. But that's what happened. And the thing that's really exciting is we had our first elections in May 2016, and there was a whole slate of candidates that ran, and they were brilliant. They were all first-time candidates, and they were all really diverse in very meaningful ways. Then another woman ran for a council by-election. Again, brilliant woman, first-time politician. And we've just announced our mayoral candidate for the Metro Mayor elections in Liverpool in this coming May. And again, a woman who is first-time into running for political office, a woman who was born on a council estate. She's called Tabitha Morton. She's a wonderful, wonderful candidate. So that's what we were doing in founding the party. It was trying to find ways to bring other women through and bring more women through and a greater diversity of women through.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, founding the party set you on the course for writing this latest book, Attack of the 50 Feet Women, How Gender Equality Can Save the World. And it's a marvellous book. It's funny. It's personal. There are lots of great stories in it. And in the introduction, of course, you look at the whole kind of spectrum of issues. Emancipation, why after World War II, when women had fought so hard and were being taken absolutely seriously for the most part, did they go back to being who they were? Before we get into actually what's in the book, why the title?
Well, I said that I was a fan of science fiction. I'm also a fan of science fiction B-movies. And there is a hilarious 1958 movie, unintentionally hilarious, except you kind of know that the people making those movies did know how funny they were, called Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, singular. And that is a parable of how scary women are when their powers are unleashed. And it's a story in which a woman married very unhappily to a cheating husband who's planning to take her millions and be with his girlfriend. She has the unhappy wife has an encounter with a space alien, which turns her from a normal sized woman into a 50-foot woman who eventually rampages and kills the husband and cheating girlfriend. And it is, as I say, it's all about how scary women would be if unleashed. So to me, that was just a useful image. And it tied in my mind with something I actually start the book with, which there was a dreadful Dolce & Gabbana advertising campaign some years ago with Scarlett Johansson, who's, you know, one of the more intelligent actresses out there, but looking absolutely not very intelligent. And the sort of slack-jawed, pouting look that you get on those sorts of cosmetics adverts. And these huge, huge posters of her draped across London's red buses just haunted me for a whole season when that campaign was up. So it made me think about 50-foot billboard women, the sort of women rendered as objects. And so it was a helpful series of images for me to start thinking about this huge topic I wanted to address, which was, why are we where we are now? Mm. What is feminism? What can feminism do? And what would the gender equal future look like? And to address it globally. So I'm glad you like the book. I have to say, nobody can accuse me of lacking ambition in the subject matter.
Well, it's beautifully written, and there isn't time, sadly, to go into all of the lovely stories, but I'm sure people will buy the book to do that. But what would an equal society look like?
Well, one of my beliefs is that the way in which society is organised now benefits actually only a very few people, not even most men. And a more equal society is one that would be more equal in other ways too. It wouldn't necessarily, for example, banish racism or homophobia, but it would have that tendency, because if you take away one of the structural inequality, this huge one between men and women, it begins to make visible and make easier to tackle some of the other things. But it would also be one in which you had to have quite a lot of debates, which are difficult, about how do you deal with the things that reinforce where we are now. My belief is that you need to have a culturally rich and culturally diverse future Equalia, as I call it, and that it is possible to do that. And that means that you have a society that is very fond of context in terms of its cultural heritage. So it doesn't get rid of things, it doesn't censor, but it does contextualize. And one that in the family structures is probably a lot more fluid. And of course, the future world of work is going to look very different. So it is also taking into account some of these other changes that are going to happen, whether we get more equal or not.
How do we achieve that, though? I mean, positive discrimination, of course, is one way that's been suggested. Is that a good thing?
Well, in terms of quotas, yes, but only in conjunction with other things. You know, people look at quotas and say they promote mediocrity. It's the most nonsensical argument, because there are unofficial quotas in favour of white men that operate all the time. And they do indeed, in that sense, promote mediocrity, because they keep out a range of talent that doesn't look quite like the people in power. And a lot of that's to do with unconscious bias. So quotas can be helpful mechanisms, but they don't solve anything on their own. And they need to be in conjunction with all sorts of other mechanisms. The Women's Equality Party has 7 core objectives, because we don't think it is possible to achieve equality without addressing all sorts of things. But if I had to single out one of them that might make a really big difference, it would be around parenting. It's around changing the culture on parenting and caregiving to see it as something, a shared joy and responsibility, which has already been achieved in some of the Nordic countries to a much greater extent by recasting maternity leave as parental leave, and by having a use it or lose it portion of the parental leave for men, and investing in it, understanding that that will also boost the economy. But you have to set the level of the payments high enough that men can afford to take it, because of the existing gender pay gap. So that's how these things all kind of reinforce each other. Mm. There's another thing that I'm engaged in organising, which is for 2018, a Women's Day Off, like they had in Iceland in 1975. I wanted to find out why Iceland is routinely voted or assessed as the most gender equal country in the world. And I discovered that in 1975, something which is often mistakenly called the women's strike, it was actually a celebration, a day off. 90% of the women in Iceland took the day off, with the agreement, in most cases, of employers and with unions, and men having to support them in this effort. And it changed attitudes in the country overnight in a really fundamental and important way. It made men feminists as well as women. It made them understand the struggle as being their own, and that they would also benefit. And that's why we are wanting to organise that here. Mm-hmm. But to organise something of that scale in a country as big and complex as this one is a big and complex job.
Absolutely. Well, this programme is going out around International Women's Day, so happy International Women's Day to us. Should we need a gift? This is the perfect one. Catherine Mayer's book, Attack of the 50 Feet Women, How Gender Equality Can Save the World. It's published by HQ and it's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks to the production team of Sam Impey and Claire Urban, to researchers Tom Furs and Helena Jarit. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or our app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.